Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Then when you call me that night to tell me that things they weren't going all right, where's your boyfriend? Was it me? Or did you just want somebody to talk to?
Radio Network, The Horn.
This is a top to, we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
and the amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
You put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on The Horn. It's Boxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Boxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
All right, everyone, how are you? Welcome aboard to Foxed Up here for That was kind of weak. We'll go for that one. Welcome aboard, folks. It's, what is it, Wednesday night, Thursday morning, or Thursday afternoon, all depending on where you reside on this beautiful blue marble such that it still is the planet Earth. We got a cool show today, I reckon. I mentioned yesterday the story about this family who teach permaculture around the United States who had their bus absconded by police. And, you know, they were up in Minnesota, you know, they were near the RNC, but weren't actually there for anything regarding the convention. So, you know, it's all a bit of that overreaction over, you know, petty ridiculousness. But that's not really why we're here. We'll probably talk about that a little bit, but I'm much more interested in Stan Wilson and his family. And I have to get back to my notes here because, you know, as you know, my short-term memory is horrible. But Stan, Delilah, and Megan are the Wilson family, and they teach permaculture in a home converted bus that they live in. And I think, instead of me blabbering on, I think we should just bring Stan Wilson onto the program. Stan, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
G'day, mate. Welcome.
I'm here.
Welcome to the Head On Radio Network. Thanks for being there.
Well, thanks for having us on.
Well, you know, I don't know where to start because you and I had a little bit of a chat yesterday, and you know, there was this whole story that brought you to my attention about your bus being absconded and fighting to get it back. But I think more important is the work that you're doing. And I wonder, before actually getting into the little ugly story, I think you should tell the more important part of what this seemingly life task that your family has taken on. I think it's fantastic.
Well, we about 3 years ago, we started, my wife and my daughter and I started talking about formalizing some of the impromptu trainings that we found ourselves doing just in friends' homes. Oftentimes when we were out visiting folks, we'd start, we'd share food with them, and a lot of the food that we share is food that we've canned or somehow otherwise stored, you know, for ourselves. And we started doing impromptu workshops in people's homes, showing them how to can food and things like that, how to do things like take care of their pets and use animals in a system to where, you know, the animals are doing work for you and as well as being companion animals and that. And we decided that we wanted to be a little bit more formal, and we started talking about going out on the road and teaching people things of what we call homesteading skills, of which permaculture is certainly a part, and that's how to can food and how to preserve food and how to be a little bit more self-sufficient. And we started calling it the Skills for the New Millennium Tour, and that's actually a line that came out of a poem that I had written about teaching my daughter old skills for a new millennium. And we were thinking about this right after the turn of the most recent century. And in January of 2007, one of the many people that we work with from time to time is a woman by the name of Starhawk. She's a pagan writer and a pagan activist, and she also does a training called an Earth Activist Training, which is a two-week intensive permaculture training that's offered in a variety of different places in the United States. And we started talking with her, and one of the things she had always dreamed of is having a school bus that would go to festivals and fairs and show people how to use things like alternative energy sources like solar panels and that. And we put the two ideas together, and in May of 2007, we purchased a big green school bus that we now drive around in, that the Earth Activist Training Demonstration Bus. We lovingly call it the Permi Bus. And we launched on this tour in February of this year. We left California and flowing a southern route across the United States, stopping at a variety of different places, people's homes, eco villages that have sprung up in the United States, church groups, campuses, and a variety of other venues where we teach a variety of different skills in which permaculture is a very big part of that. So that's what the idea was, and the idea came to fruition, and we've been on the road doing that since February. We've been from San Francisco to Long Island, so I just tell people we've actually been from sea to shining sea.
That's fantastic, you know, and I like this idea of a skill set for the new millennium, because I think you've come up with a great moniker for what I think is a really growing movement, and it's not just in the United States, it's not just here in Australia. you know, kind of globally. I'm getting the impression that, I don't know if it has something to do with the availability of information on the internet, that people are wanting to reconnect with the food that they put in their bodies. You know, and whether, I'm not sure if it's, you know, because people have become more educated and found out how disconnected we've come from, you know, the very thing that gives us sustenance. And so this idea of people wanting to move to a different way than just depending on a corporate model to bring them the food that they think that they want to have, as opposed to having real food. I think this is I think you're like right on top of a continually growing wave. I hope you've seen that while you've been out.
Well, we've seen a lot of that while we've been out. It's really something that people are really grasping for and are really reaching out for and are, in fact, really, really excited about getting this idea of food self-sufficiency and self-sufficiency around energy and around our, you know, our water uses. And really, you know, here in the United States and to a degree in the Western world and the developed world, we're a little bit behind the curve on things. People in third world countries have been fighting for to keep their food independence and to keep their small farms.
Yeah.
And to keep away from companies like Monsanto and that, who want to control the seed production and everything, for quite a bit now. And, you know, in the United States, you know, permaculture came to the United States in the late 80s, early 90s, and has really latched on in the last 10 to 15 years to be something that, you know, it's something that people are craving for. I think people all across the world understand that the corporate model of control of our food and our resources is not going to benefit individuals or communities at all. It's only designed to benefit the corporations. And people see that they, you know, people are really, really grasping for a way to break out of what, out of this trap that we've gotten ourselves into with our dependency on corporations. And, you know, we kind of started off on this thing not really knowing what the reception was going to be like, but what we have found is that everywhere we have been, people are really excited by this, and it leaves them really, really feeling that, you know, We can move from despair over maybe our lost freedom and our lost liberty and move into an area of empowerment where, you know, there is a way out where communities and individuals and neighborhoods can get together to control their own, you know, to control their own destiny.
Yeah, there's definitely that. When you and I spoke on the phone yesterday, I mentioned this film Garbage Warrior about the guy who did the Earth ships. And one of the things that he says in the film, when he built his first Earthship for his family, where they were producing all their own energy, growing all of their own food, and the food production was actually part of the home, the way that they do it. You know, it's this experimental thing. And he said, you know, after they got it going, he suddenly woke up one day and realized, I'm free. This is actual freedom. His life
and
was.
It is. You know.
Go ahead, please.
You know, it is freedom. You know, when we're, you know, when we can actually grow our own food and we can put our own food on the table and we know where it's coming from, you know, there is a real sense of, you know, if we can do, you know, a variety of really, really simple things, and we latched on to a couple of concepts, and one of them, our mission statement, is cultivating revolutionary ways of living. And when we talk with people about that, sometimes you get kind of, you know, an interesting reaction, because, you know, the word revolution is a really, really loaded word, and it means a lot of different things to different people, and people become somewhat concerned over the fact that we're using this language. But then when we start talking about people making changes at the margins, where people really change their lives, you know, doing the simple things one at a time that you can do that are within the grasp of people, and then, you know, when you combine that, when you combine, you know, planting an organic garden, which, you know, does a variety of different things, of which almost a byproduct of that is growing your own food and, you know, and gaining some food self-sufficiency. When people start doing little things like that, pretty soon enough people have changed enough places at the margin to where they really have cultivated a revolutionary way of living. And it's happened in such a manner to where it's a quiet revolution, to where, you know, by the time it's done, nobody's latched onto it except for the people that have done it, and but, you know, and then it's complete, and people have taken that really, really, really big step towards freedom, and, you know,
yeah,
being able to eat food to grow is a really, really freeing thing.
It's I have to say from the last couple of years now that, you know, our household has really taken this on, it has got to be one of the most gratifying things I have ever done. And I have to give most of the credit to my missus for actually taking it on, and she's the real green thumb. I do what I'm told and, you know, lug heavier stuff around. But it's just, it's the most amazing thing to just sit there and watch, you know, Mother Nature do its thing in the back. And, you know, there are times here, you know, we're still fine tuning how we do it, how to, you know, stretch out yields and things like that. And, you know, you find out that you have like these times where you have more than you could possibly consume. And I'm like running bags of, you know, salad greens and stuff over to, you know, the neighbors that I actually know. And I think, you know, expanding this not by much, another neighbor or two taking care of a couple of other things, and like an entire block or two could actually get together very simply and like support one another.
And then what happens from that is that people start looking at, you know, one of the, you know, a whole bunch of permaculture principles come into play here, and, you know, people start looking at some of the problems in their neighborhoods, and people start looking at things like oftentimes, in the United States, especially in urban areas. And one of the things we really started doing is generating our teaching towards urban areas. And, you know, oftentimes when you start talking to people about doing things like growing food in urban areas, this light goes on, and, you know, and they look at you like you're some kind of genius, and really pure demographics, you know. Most people on this planet live in urban areas. And so in neighborhoods where there's a lot of empty lots, when people and, you know, when people start providing their own food and they start composting and they start doing water catchment, they start doing gray water, and they start doing all these very, very empowering things, pretty soon what they're doing, they're beginning on a very, very local grassroots level to start, you know, interfacing with city policy and with county policies and that, because then you start taking over abandoned lots and you start having community gardens, and you move from doing something that might be in many communities illegal because, you know, it's private property, to doing things where you're affecting policy to such a degree to where, you know, the lawmakers have no choice but to bend to the popular will that, you know, these problems, these vacant lots in our areas can become a solution to not only neighborhood empowerment, but to food production. And in urban areas, there's so many places where people can grow the food they need to grow that, you know, makes it so with the rising cost of fuel and everything, bringing food in from rural areas to urban areas just makes it more and more difficult for people, especially poor people, to be able to afford to eat food, like especially organic food, which tend to cost a little bit more. And all around the world, in places like Havana, Cuba, for example, Havana, Cuba meets 80% of its own food needs from inside the city limit.
Right.
It's the types of things that on a neighborhood level we can start doing.
Yeah, you know, I really think that we are on an edge, you know, just kind of like at the beginning of a bit of an awakening when it comes to this idea that, you know, we're not going to be able to depend on the big conglomerate outfit to get stuff to market. I think sooner rather than later, just going by the global warming science and watching what's happened with the droughts here in Australia, you know, it's been devastating. Very interesting news. I don't know if you've heard about this, Stan, but I found this just before my missus found this just before going to air. This could actually have some real impact on all of these issues. A jury in the UK, I don't know if you remember, not long ago, some environmental activists climbed up a coal-fired power plant and, you know, painted Gordon, started painting some sort of message, and they were going to be done for criminal trespass, all this kind of stuff, you know, $35,000 worth of damage. Get this, the jury has come down and said that the protesters had viable reason to do that damage due to the threats of global warming on the planet. It's urgent enough. They were within their rights to do the damage.
You know, that's really, really exciting news because because back at the end of World War II, they had, you know, they made a decision that not only was it a citizen's right to act in ways that were illegal, that was stopping a greater harm, but it was, in fact, a citizen's responsibility. It was the Nuremberg decision. And very, very few countries have ever allowed their citizens to enact on that. But for a jury anywhere in, you know, in this world to actually tell, to send this message out that we do have a crisis here, and the crisis, you know, the global warming, global climatic change crisis is severe enough to where citizens now are free to stand up to the responsibility of citizens, not only of, say, for instance, the UK, but of the world, to do something like that is really, really exciting and really encouraging, because that is one of the things that really disempowers people, is the idea that you may want to do something like that, but it's illegal, and you know, you're going to go to jail, you're going to have to pay big fines, and so, and that keeps people from from acting in ways that they might otherwise really, really want to act. Because the truth is that people everywhere, at least in the United States that we've been in contact with, you know, people who are doing, you know, the most normal thing, they're doing that 9-to-5 thing, they really want to find some way to reach out to say enough. And they're just afraid, and they're afraid of the laws of a country that are guided mostly by the needs of corporations. And
yeah.
For little kinks in the armor of the corporate state.
Yeah.
You know, to come out is really, really an empowering thing.
Yeah, because we've spoken at great length on this network on how, you know, because people have, you know, are worried about, one, legal implications, and then also just current economic environment, people are working really hard, and so most of the biggest protests or gatherings end up happening on a weekend when it's the dead time for the news cycle, and so the protest basically didn't happen because the news wasn't there to cover it. And I think that also adds into people saying, you know, I'd go stick my neck out, but to what avail? The last three times I went and we had 10,000 people out there, you didn't see spit about it. Here's spit about it in the media. So, you know, I mean, it's really odd times. So this has to be empowering. And just from the article, it says, jurors accepted defense arguments that the six had a lawful excuse to damage property at Kingsworth North Power Station in Kent to prevent even greater damage caused by climate change. The defense of lawful excuse under the Criminal Damage Act 1971 allows damage to be caused to property to prevent even greater damage, such as breaking down a door of a burning house to tackle a fire.
Right, right.
And
that's really, really encouraging.
And my partner is English, and she said, oh, and this is perfect. Everyone on both sides of politics in the UK, they all hate the government. So they're all going to be going whoopee to the courts because they've told the government, you know, basically, you're the only one standing in the way. Because this was a protest over, you know, a coal-based future for the UK. And now they're able to come out and say, look, the courts even back us up. You're the only ones, not the people, not the law, not the courts, not the science. And the thing that they did, and this is where I think the environmental fight is getting better, and including the things that you're doing, it's getting much more real world for regular people. But they had who's that NASA guy who first started the whole global warming vibe in introduced it to the Americans in 88 or whatever. He 4 hours of testimony. And they're like, you know, we just listened to the premier scientist for 4 hours. We're going to disagree with him? You're kidding. No. I think it's one of the best things. I think this could have serious ramifications because, you know, that's going to end up impacting on the EU as a whole, who's doing a lot better job.
Right.
About getting.
It's going to have impact on the world court.
Yes. And this is.
Well, eventually trickle down, you know, even to the good old U.S. of A, where we tend to, you know, because I think we're leaving that mindset where we really believe that we can ignore world opinion. And it hasn't worked well for the last 8 years. And I think we're getting more into a place where people are seeing that we have to pay attention to world opinion.
Yeah.
And that if we're going to be a world leader, we really have to pay attention to what world opinion is.
Yeah, it actually does make a difference because, I mean, I've been down here in Australia for 10 years now, so I've been able to watch the Bush administration from a frustrated distance. And, you know, the last 8 years have been a disaster in almost every way, and we haven't seen kind of just environmental consciousness be rolled back like it has been, but I think we're seeing it we're seeing the inverse come back now. People are really waking up to what's happening. I mean, just look at the UK. The last 2 years have been flooded unbelievably. You know, we've had, we've just had, what, how many storms in the Gulf in like 2 weeks? And it's only the beginning, you know.
And going over the early spring here in the United States, there was a lot of flooding in the Midwest. It was kind of interesting because we were on the road during that period. And it was kind of a good news, bad news scenario. You know, we were ducking around the flooding. We could see the signs of the flooding. And in some cases, you could see, you know, you could get a really good idea of how severe it had been. And we're from Montana originally, and Montana has been in a 10-year drought cycle. It's been a pretty nasty drought cycle. And over the last winter, they started, you know, snow cap was 200% of normal in many places in the high Rockies in Montana. And, of course, what that does is that when the snow melts, it raises the river, you know, the water levels in the rivers that flow into the Missouri, which then flow into the Mississippi, which is good for the state of Montana, but it probably had a very, very bad effect on the Mississippi drainage because it probably was a contributing factor to all of the flooding. So, you know, severe weather, whether it, you know, can sometimes be good in some places or at least appear to have a good effect in some places, it's downstream effect, and you always have to be aware of that downstream effect. It's something that can be very, very negative. So, you know, it was interesting jaunting around, you know, the Midwest over the course of the spring and the early summer and getting into this area where they had just come out of severe flooding.
Right. Well, because I remember reading about after the Iowa floods, they really said that was the severity of it was caused by man's reengineering of the flatlands. And the way that they've, you know, kind of manipulated the smaller stream systems for irrigation, and it can no longer handle what it used to be able to handle in runoff because, you know, the soil's all loose and cleared. But a big thing is the reengineering of the water systems up there. I just, you know, I hadn't realized that it had been so man-made, kind of reengineered the water systems up there, but it seems to have had devastating effects.
Well, they've had to do a lot of things over, you know, they've had to do a lot of things that they increased production, especially in very, very, you know, in a very, very large factory farms. And what they've done in a lot of cases is they've, you know, straightened out rivers and straightened out streams and done things that move water very, very quickly from one place to the other. And, of course, what that creates when you get into flooding areas is that it, you know, it's just, you know, it's just a straight shot right into a floodplain. And where then it's, you know, with enough severe rains, and there was a lot of severe rains in the early spring, there's no controlling it. I mean, the levees were built at a time when the reengineering of natural contours for agribusiness wasn't happening, so there was no way those levees could be designed to, you know, to stand up to that. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that really is getting people latching on to, you know, ideas of what can we do about this now. I mean, what do we do about the water? What are new ways of handling water? And, of course, one of the things that we go around the country, you know, in teaching folks about permaculture, one of the, you know, permaculture takes a completely different look at how to handle water. And the mantra of permaculture is pretty much, you know, you make running water walk, you make walking water stand, and then water has time to drain into the ground table and refill, you know, and refill the aquifers and everything in a sensible way that doesn't just destroy the entire water system.
People can
look at that and they say, well, sure, you know, if we slow down, we'll be able to use it, and it's not going to cause all this damage. And out of the problem comes the solution, and that's something that really makes people stand up and take notice and see that it's, you know, they don't need the Army Corps of Engineers to come in and,
right. Now,
and do what they do.
Do you mind just going back a little bit? You said something about running water stands. Can you explain that a little bit more in detail, what you mean by that?
Well, the traditional way of handling water in Western culture is that we create irrigation zones. And irrigation zones are usually pretty straight canals. and they're designed to move water from one place to the other relatively quickly and in a nice straight line so that the farms can access it in a very, very, very extractive manner. And in permaculture, the way nature works with water is that except for in cases of severe flooding, which happens, you know, which in many cases is necessary, but it happens for a very, very short period of time in areas that are spread out. You don't really never, you know, you don't really see a lot of massive flooding in any one area in a natural system. And the way water is handled in a natural system is that when water is running very, very fast, when it's coming off the mountainsides, when it's, you know, when it's coming out of the high Rockies, it'll eventually get to a point to where there's a natural, the natural environment begins to slow the water down. And what that generally means is that it starts, you know, starts sloping more gradually. And then there's lakes and there's ponds and everything, and the purpose of them is to make what is now walking water stand. And then what happens is that water is absorbed into the ground very, very slowly, where it's filtered, and it goes into the aquifers, and it continuously refills the aquifers. That's the way water is controlled in a natural system.
Excellent. No, that's one of the most concise kind of explanations I've ever heard of anything. So when you're going to, just to kind of shift gears, I want to get back to the actual bus. What does the bus do? What does the bus have? You know, tell us a little bit about this bus you've built.
So the bus is a 1984 Bluebird All-American school bus, and she's a 40-foot bus that we purchased for a series of particular reasons. It was an activity bus, you know, and what that meant is that it has storage underneath on the outside, and it's 74 inches high, so if you're over 6 feet tall, you can actually stand in it. It had a diesel engine, and we wanted the diesel engine so that we could burn biodiesel in the bus. And it has two fuel tanks, and that comes in handy because sometimes in cold weather, even if you got biodiesel on board, you need to have a second smaller tank so you can have some diesel on board to get the engine running up to the right temperature so it can go through the biodiesel without clogging up its filters. And so we took this bus, and we got a $10,000 grant from the Earth Activist Training, and the grant was for the purchase of the bus and to put the alternative systems on the bus that we have. And so we have a solar system on the bus. We have a couple of solar panels up on the roof, and then we have batteries and a charge controller and an inverter. And we have the whole system designed where it's a teaching tool. And the way we have it set up is that a person could look at how our system is put together, and then they could take that and they could plug that into, you know, their need very, very simply, because we have very, very simple diagrams and schematics and everything. And we put the thing together not only so that it was inexpensive as possible, but also so that it was as easy as used as possible. And we have a gray water system on board in the bus, and our primary source of gray water is our kitchen sink. And we also have a system set up for rainwater catchment, and we have a hydroponic garden on the bus. And then we carry three chickens with them. And the hydroponic garden is actually a system that was designed by some American graduate students who went down to Mexico and studied the shanty towns outside of Mexico City and used PVC pipe, because PVC pipe is everywhere, to devise systems where people in the shanty towns could return to being food producers.
Absolutely.
And so we have a hydroponic garden on the bus. We also have a worm bin on the bus so we can not only compost our own food quickly. One of the challenges of the bus is that you always have storage problems. You know, we don't have a lot of room to store a lot of stuff, so we have to do things like turn table waste into soil very, very quickly. So we have a worm bin on the bus, and then we have three chickens that we carry along with us, and we have a humanure toilet system on the bus. And you know, humanure system is based on the system that Joel Jenkins designed in the 1970s. And he's the guy who wrote the book, The Humanure Handbook. And all these systems are not only designed for our use, but they're also designed as outreach tools and as teaching tools.
First of all, I'm just green with envy. You've kind of done everything that we're kind of dreaming of doing with a static home, and you've been able to make it into this mobile thing. I think it is one of the coolest things I've ever heard of.
It's a really, really, really great bus. And of course, we have a full size kitchen in there, and we have a reading room, and we have benches for people to sit on that also can be set up in such a manner to where they form a 7x8 living space. And then we have a bedroom for my daughter, and then my wife and I have our bedroom, and then we have a little private toilet area.
I mean,
it's a house.
This is your home.
It's
no
our
joke.
Home. This is where we live. I mean, we don't have. We have a storage location in Montana where we keep our stuff, but this is where we live. We're living on the bus, and that was one of the things that made it particularly stressful when the bus was impounded, because not only were they taking our teaching tool from us, but they were taking our home from us. But, you know, the good news is that, you know, we got the bus back, and we have our home back, and we're back on the road, and we're setting up appearances. And we're taking a brief rest up from a very, very busy couple of weeks, and then we're going to be back doing it again.
Well, you made a selection for a track of the day today, but I'll probably save that for a bit. I think since you kind of opened up the door, and without dwelling too much on it, because I really think the work you're doing is so much more important. Tell folks the story of what happened with the bus in Minneapolis.
Okay, I'll try to be as brief as possible, because I agree with you that it's not the story. The tour is the story, and really, I can say the end result of what happened with the bus is that we have now been flooded with requests for appearances, and it's helped our fundraising. We do everything entirely on donations, and our donations have spiked. And so a lot of good things have come out of this little incident. What happened was is that we came into Minneapolis on the 2nd of August and had appearances throughout the city to do permaculture trainings. And the Republican National Convention was also in St. Paul, which is just across the river, in the last week. And we were doing some things in and around the Republican National Convention. One of the things we wanted to do with the convention is that beyond the protests which are going on, we also wanted to show people what a different way of living could look like, both as a way of education and as a way of protest. So we were doing events around the city in conjunction with the protest. And on August 30th, we were driving over from Minneapolis to St. Paul, and we were pulled over by the St. Paul police and quickly were surrounded by 15 different officers from 5 different jurisdictions. And you know, in the end, they impounded the bus. They gave us a variety of different reasons for why they were impounding the bus, to range from the one that we thought was probably closest to the truth, which was they wanted to take the bus in case they wanted to execute a search at a later date, which is, of course, a violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. And they went down the list of there, and they took the bus from us and left us on the side of the road. They let us take our 3 dogs and our 3 chickens and some food, our personal items like our toiletries and my daughter's shoes, and a lot of other things were left on the bus. And luckily enough, we have a large network of supporters, and we were able to call on them. And that evening, we were housed, and we spent the week on the telephone and speaking with folks. And the Minneapolis Police Department found out that business as usual is very difficult to do when you have thousands of phone calls coming in from places as far away as Scotland and Wales demanding the return of the permibus. And the city of Minneapolis got very, very upset when they discovered that, you know, what they had done was that they were spending all day talking with folks about organic gardening and not doing their business. And finally, on Wednesday, I had a conversation with the city attorney, and they kind of took the position of, oops, you know, we've made a terrible mistake. And on Thursday, they gave me back our bus, free and clear. They decided they wanted to eat all the impound fees and the storage fees and the towing fees. And they had come up with a list of 23 violations. Most of them had to do with trying to categorize the bus illegally as a commercial vehicle, which it's not. And they removed all of them. And they restored our freedom of movement, which we thought was mighty nice of them, seeing how we live in a democracy. And we have the bus back. And what happened over the course of that 4 very, very, very busy and, yes, very, very stressful days was that we, our network of supporters grew by leaps and bounds. And, you know, we've you know, permaculture people are coming out of the weeds and just from everywhere, you know, because people went on the internet and what they learned about was not only the illegal, you know, seizure of this bus, which is, you know, certainly a very, very stressful thing, but what really got put out there is that everywhere, all over the internet was permaculture and the tour and what we're doing and how permaculture can be used to make the world a better place and how doing little simple things like organic gardening is something an individual can do to help combat global, you know, global climatic change. And this is really, really, this is the really important message. And this is the message that everybody from, you know, very, very right-wing conservative folks to, you know, the most left-leaning, you know, anarchists can latch onto and all come together and say, yes, this is what we want to learn how to do.
Yeah, I saw a bit of that a couple of weeks ago. There was this the Gardening Australia Expo was here, and my missus and I went. And Gardening Australia is a program that's all based on organics, and it's been going in this country for like 25 years or something. And I was looking around, thinking, you know, because this isn't you know show garden kind of stuff. This is much more about indigenous stuff, producing all organic, and I'm looking around at just the diverse, just swath of people from all walks of life. From I saw like a group of six bikies over at a permaculture display, which sounds like a small form of what you do that someone's doing here. And I just looked and I said, you know, this really is probably going to be the thing that's going to unite this world as a people, is getting back in touch.
We did a training in a little town in Arizona called Cornville, and by the name you can imagine what Cornville's like. It's a very, very conservative place.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in this woman's living room, and our training was a bunch of people who, you know, self-described Presbyterian conservatives. And they were, you know, we did our permaculture 101 and talked about chickens and composting and vermiculture and a variety of other things. And then on the other side of the country in Columbus, Ohio, we did a canning workshop with a bunch of anarchist kids.
Excellent.
And, you know, they called us up a couple of weeks ago, and they had been dumpster diving and then just turning everything into smoothies and trying to drink as many smoothies as they possibly could in a given day to make use of all this food they were getting. And they called us up about a week later and said, you know, we're canning everything in sight. And they had really, really latched on to group canning as a way of getting people together, as a way of organizing people, as a way of coming together as a community, and as a way of providing themselves with very, very good food that they can then share with people. And so, you know, it's something, it's across the board, you know, and a whole lot of people in the middle. And, you know, it's been a way to reach out to inner city communities. We were in Arizona pretty early on, and we were doing an appearance at this urban farm in Phoenix. And one of the workers there, who is, you know, this Hispanic guy from old Mexico, asked me what I was doing, because he saw our posters up, and I spoke with him a bit about the trainings we were doing. He looked up at me, and he was pulling some weeds, and he said, "Thank you." And I said, "For what?" And he said, "You know, you gringos are finally getting it. This is the way we live in the rest of the world. And, you know, you're finally getting it, and you're sharing this with people so that, you know, life can be better for everybody." And, you know, that was a real eye-opener that, yeah, you know, that is what this is all about, is, you know, taking a few simple things and using it as a way to make life better for everybody. And doing it in such a manner to where, you know, it's not that idea that, you know, you're just barely scraping by and everything is kind of humdrum and gloomy. You know, this is a celebration of food. It's the celebration of the harvest. So it's a celebration of life.
And
you know, and that's what true resistance is.
And food is spiritual. I have no doubt about it. I find, you know, I lived in San Antonio for quite a long time, and I think I was more part of the Mexican community than I was of the Anglo community. And so much of that whole communal vibe that they have is just around the concept of getting together around food. And I always found that to be so beautiful and healthy, and something that I just would think, you know, we so don't get it as white people.
No, we don't. You know, 'cause, you know, food is something we eat because we need to. And when you go into, you know, when you go into poor communities or, you know, other cultures, food is what everything is gathered around. And, you know, and the most important things that we as citizens of any place that we're at need to take care of is food, energy, and water. And if we can take care of in our health, and if we can do those four things, we can, you know, build strong communities that when they need to, they can resist the corporate state effectively. And when the corporate state leaves us alone, we can celebrate life and make our community stronger and really interact in a way to where we can say, you know, yeah, I really am going to be doing something that's going to make my great-great-grandchildren's life better.
Mate, this has been just one of the coolest conversations I've ever had on this program. I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us, and I wish you and Delilah and your daughter Megan, who I had a great conversation with on the phone yesterday, all the best of luck, and please never hesitate to ring this program to get in touch with us or the network if you're going to be somewhere, especially if you end up in West Virginia. I guarantee you Bob and Agnes will want to come out and say hello.
That's very good. We've had some opportunities to do some permaculture work in Appalachia. So that's one of the things we're looking at.
We've worked around
how to rebuild after mountaintop removal.
Ah, excellent, mate. And ELO, our one of our news ninjas, has posted an in-depth post about you guys on our blog with links to the photos and links to the story and links to your live journal so people can get more information. We're putting you on the blog roll because I really do want to keep in touch with you and just to get updates on you, educating people on it.
That is about doing too.
Yeah, and so you just take care of yourself, mate, and you all enjoy your break that you're taking, and I wish you all the best, and I hope to speak with you very soon.
And you too.
All right, man. Thank you so much. And that was Stan Wilson from the Permibus family. How cool was that? And instead of having him hang on the phone to listen to the track, I figure, you know, we're kind of coming up on the end of things here, so I made the offer to Stan saying, hey, you know, we do music on this show. Do you have a track that you'd like to recommend? And so he sent on Michelle Shocked. And the version that I found, I don't know if this is the version that you were talking about, but or actually ELO found for me, Michelle Shocked with Doc Watson and Strawberry Jam. This is a really neat tune. We'll play this out, take a little break, come and wrap it up. You're listening to Foxed Up on the Head On Radio Network.
Morning found me itching to get on over to my grandma's kitchen.
What you gonna do, honey?
The sweetest little berries was cooking up right, and then we put them in a canning jar and seal them up tight. We were making jam.
What kind?
Strawberry jam, that's what kind.
Oh, the good kind.
Yeah, if you want the best jam, you got to make your own. Smuckers, Welch's, Knott's Berry Farm, but a little homemade jam never did a body no harm. A little local motion is all we really need to close down these corporate jam factories. We'll be making jam, strawberry jam. If you want the best jam, you got to make your own. Make that jam, Doc, show 'em how it's done. Everybody's making homemade jam. So won't you call your friends up on the telephone? You invite make your own. Go on, Jerry, let the jelly roll. Jerry's making jam.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Drugs and alcohol, everybody loves it, and so do I. And President George W. Bush will party tonight. Damn the consequences. Another shot, the sky's the limit. We resolve to party all the way to God.
Everybody, here we go. We're just about on the end of things here. So, you know, that was great. That was great. So head to the blog. Check out the links for the permaculture bus. And check out the photos. I got photos of it being seized and all that crazy stuff. But I think what is so much more important is the work that these folks are doing. I rant and rave at great length on this program about getting back in touch with our food. And I think what these folks are doing is a great step in, you know, getting people to get with the program, A, as we say. And, you know, I just get really excited. Boy, have I changed in this life. I'm jealous of the chickens. I want chickens. Gail's got me on this thing. I want chickens. Yeah, yeah. We're looking at these little, you know, chicken trailers that you can get. Big enough for a couple of chicks, and you can pull them around to weed different parts of the lawn. from the guy that used to live in and amongst technology and in trucks and everything, and now I want chickens. But, you know, again, big thanks to the Wilson family and Stan for spending time with us today. And, you know, and like I said, we're just this whole thing about this jury decision in the UK, I'm going to read up and see if any more stuff comes up before tomorrow, because this is fascinating stuff. This could seriously be setting some, you know, legal precedent that, you know what? You're doing the damage. You're doing more damage. You know, these industries. So, you know, someone bringing it to light because no one's listening, they are justified. I think that I can hear the right wingers. This probably won't even catch air in the United States. You know, it's only going to be the alternative media that'll cover it. But, you know, if a right winger does get it, they're going to be going on, "That damn Europeans, those silly Europeans. We don't recognize they law." But hey, you know, that's just kind of, you know, where it is and where we're going to leave it for today. So I want to thank Agnes Kincaid for manning the phones for me today. Thanks to Ben Birch of the White Rose Society for the streaming and the archives. Thanks to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, for supporting The Horn. And you, too, can be part of the fight against mountaintop removal mining. And as we say here on Fox Stop, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
And the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply. So I tucked my hair up under my hat. I went in to ask him why. He said, "You look like a fine, upstanding young man. I think you do." So I took off my hat. I said, "Imagine that. Huh, me working for you." Whoa. Sign, sign, everywhere a sign. Blocking out the scenery, breaking my mind. Do this, don't do that. Can't you read? So I jumped on the fence and I yelled at the house, "Hey, what gives you the right to put up a fence to keep me out or to keep Mother Nature in? If God was here, he'd tell you to your face, man, you're some kind of sign, sign, everywhere a sign, blocking out the scenery, breaking my mind. Do this, don't do that, can't you read?"
Everybody's open.